Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with your host, executive editor of Newsbusters, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome to the conservative book club we call the Newsbusters podcast. We have a new crop of tell-all books on Donald Trump. Former top Melania staffer Stephanie Grisham has one. Fiona Hill, who was famous for 15 minutes in the Ukraine impeachment, is also making the rounds of liberal media outlets. But this has been ongoing for a long time. I mean, the Trump tell-all started early. I mean, Omarosa was out with a tell-all in the summer of 2018. And the trail is just keeps going. It's just really never stopped. We have a book publishing industry that was deeply invested in running negative, hyper-negative books about Donald Trump. But this is the essential question for you. Does anyone remember a crop of tell-all books from insiders about Barack and Michelle Obama? Oh, no. Because anyone who tattled on the Jay-Z and Beyonce of politics would have been drummed out of polite society. Spokesmen for the Clintons or the Obamas, like Mike McCurry and Jay Carney, quickly became millionaires in supportive business operations without any need for a lucrative book deal. I mean, does anybody remember a juicy bucket of tell-all books from insiders about Bill and Hillary Clinton? We can only imagine the ribald tales we could receive. We did get books from security personnel. FBI agent Gary Aldrich, who was posted inside the White House, wrote a book called Unlimited Access that Regnery published in the summer of 1996. That was mostly about how Bill and Hillary Clinton granted access to a lot of people who didn't really require much security vetting. The scandal at that time in 96 was about the use of raw FBI files that the Clinton White House used, particularly of Bush White House employees. So there was stuff there to discuss, but the Clinton White House was very angry that anybody was going to publicize this book. This Week with David Brinkley booked an interview with Aldrich, and Aldrich backed down on one of the hotter stories in this book, was that the claim that President Clinton snuck out of the White House for trysts in nearby hotels. Well, so Aldrich did this interview with ABC, and ABC also interviewed for rebuttal George Stephanopoulos, who at that point was still in the Clinton White House. We had no idea that this would one day be George Stephanopoulos' show. But his whole line on Aldrich was, I think someone should have to pass a bare threshold of credibility before they are put on the air to millions of viewers. And that's what happened, is that because they felt this was a book from a right-wing Clinton-hating publisher, suddenly ABC's Nightline, Dateline NBC, and CNN's Larry King Live all canceled their bookings with Aldrich. On the talk shows, journalists let Aldrich have it. Newsweek's Eleanor Clift blamed the right-wing mafia and hate radio for promoting Aldrich. The Wall Street Journal's Al Hunt on CNN's Capital Gang wasn't nice. Aldrich is sort of a dim dolt who's been manipulated by a bunch of right-wingers, and it is incumbent upon the press now to find out who, when, and why. Al Hunt didn't want the tell-all. He wanted to prosecute and investigate the writer of the tell-all and how they were manipulated by partisans. Yeah, and what's CNN doing now? A man named Gary Byrne, who had worked in the Secret Service, wrote another version of this on the Clintons that came out in the summer of 2016. But of course, Hillary was the nominee. That was a bestseller, but the networks didn't want to breathe a word about it. There was no bookings. But these two Garys were unknowns until the books came out. They weren't the chief of staff to the first lady. They weren't a press secretary. They weren't someone high up in the administration. They weren't even some middle-level bureaucrat in the Department of Homeland Security who called himself anonymous and who was presumed to be to have a higher station in the Trump administration than he actually had. So instead of being troubled with tell-alls when you're a Democrat, well, the Clintons and the Obamas raked in many millions of dollars to put out their own gushy memoirs. Then they were treated to gushy interviews. I always remember Barbara Walters doing a Hillary memoir interview, which was just, you know, it was so sugary it'd make you throw up. When Barack Obama comes out with a memoir, he selects CBS host Gail King. And it doesn't matter to anyone inside the liberal media that Gail King was not only a donor to Obama, she not only came to party with the Obamas inside the White House on their first inauguration day with Oprah, she was even vacationing with the Obamas. And this was somehow not a conflict because it's the Obamas. Barack Obama was so wonderful, he got to choose his, you know, the most sappy, conflicted interviewer, and it was just fine with everyone. Authorized biographies are the only tell-alls allowed when it comes to the top Democrats. So Stephanie Grisham's making the rounds. This was really our favorite little piece, Stephanie Grisham on New Day, where she was asked, naturally, because she's on CNN, to denounce Fox News.
What was the role of Fox News in the White House?
That's a great question. That's just where we went to get what we wanted out, you know? I looked forward to going and doing Lou Dobbs because Lou Dobbs would do all the talking about how great everything was, and I would just nod and say yes. They, you know, by and large, didn't get tough with us. They just took what we were saying and disseminated it. And I think they're disseminating it to a lot of people who went to the Capitol for January 6th. And I, you know, again, I've had a lot of time to grapple with this, and I feel horribly guilty about my part in it because I was on Fox a lot.
Was it, to you, like state-run TV for Donald Trump?
You know, a bit. I think there are some legitimate journalists at Fox News who would ask some tough questions. So I don't want to, as a whole, paint them. But I think certainly in the evening, yes, it was.
They just took what we were saying and disseminated it. Now, just take that sentence and think of Obama's 8 years in the White House. Couldn't an Obama spokesman review CNN's behavior and state, that's just where we went to get what we wanted out? By and large, they didn't get tough with us. They just took what we were saying and disseminated it. Now, it's not just CNN, of course. I mean, Barack Obama had his, you know, had a whole menu of choices. One of his favorites was Steve Inskeep at National Public Radio, and he would do a whole series of interviews where he got his rings kissed. So that's, you know, this is what's always funny, that CNN's going to say, oh, Fox, it's state-run TV. Well, who's state-run TV now? We should note, Grisham didn't get softball questions on New Day. This was CNN, and the subject was Trump. So there was lots of guilt trips there. She was asked, did you harm democracy? Did you feel you played a role in hurting democracy? And then on COVID, do you think you're enabling cost lives? And Grisham would say, I do, I do. Like she'd somehow entered the cathedral of CNN to go to the confessional. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. Ka-ching! This is all about cashing in. Now, it's not unfair to note that Fox News in the Trump years, especially in prime time, was pro-Trump territory. He had some fans there. He had some supporters there. Grisham talked about loving the Lou Dobbs show on Fox Business because she just had to nod along and barely say anything while Lou was professing how wonderful Trump was in everything he did and said. But it was easy for anyone, like Dan Abrams did, to roll out footage of Grisham last year when she was on the Lou Dobbs show, calling John Bolton a sellout when Trump's former national security advisor released his own Trump tell-all when he was celebrated by all of the same media outlets. So back then, Bolton was a sellout, but what is Grisham now? When Stephanie Winston Wolkoff wrote a memoir called Melania and Me, The Rise and Fall of My Friendship with the First Lady, last August, in August of 2020, Grisham called it an exercise in bizarre twisting of the truth and misguided blame for the sake of self-pity. Well, who is wallowing in self-pity now? In November 2019, Grisham called the anonymous author of a book about the Trump administration a coward and dismissed his book, A Warning, as a work of fiction. Well, yes, writing a book by anonymous is rather cowardly, and frankly, the book publisher could be accused of cowardice, but of course, they used the word anonymous because they thought it would sell better. It'd be better than A Warning by Miles Taylor, who you've never heard of. Personally, I would have never signed up for a position with President Trump, especially in the press office. That was obviously making a morally compromised choice, and you know you'd be expected to defend the craziest tweets or the nastiest insults the president would offer, where you'd have to say, well, but to be fair, Alicia Machado was fat. Hillary did have cankles. I mean, what would you have to say? John Bolton is a sellout. Okay. But it just seems like the height of self-serving behavior to work for Trump as candidate and as president all the way up to January 6th is like half a decade, and then suddenly flip like a pancake and say, oh, well, I was disgusted the whole time. So then she went on and on the Tapper show. This was another really interesting thing. Jake Tapper said to her, you suggest if Trump was reelected in 2024, there could be retribution and revenge against whom? Grisham, not to be joking, but I bet he'll put me in jail. I really think anybody who spoke out against him. Now she says she didn't vote for Trump, but she won't say who she voted for. I mean, can you imagine working for this person, working for this president for 4 years, and then trying to make a virtue out of the idea that you didn't vote for him? I mean, we'll have to see if Grisham will end up as a CNN or MSNBC regular, like Captain Anonymous Miles Taylor. Well, she'll be a regular on the Nicole Wallace Show, the never-Trumper former Republican channel. I mean, we understand. The conservative media would happily welcome an Obama defector or a Clinton defector or a Biden defector. But that's making a choice against the massive liberal media juggernaut. That is not an easy road for a Democrat to take. And we're here with Scott Whitlock, newly minted research director. We're going to discuss today the, since we're on the subject of books, the forthcoming memoir by Catherine Couric, the grand dame of the liberal media. Boy, you know, if she had a reputation as a, you know, a pioneer, she anchored the evening news. She's a feminist hero. She seems to be just like ripping that to shreds with this memoir. And this is clearly not the last time we're going to talk about this book because it hasn't come out yet. October 26th, Scott?
Yep.
Okay. And the New York Post has just been enjoying whatever tidbits they're getting or gossip or whatever. But Scott did a piece with some of the lowlights. I don't think we can call them highlights. Just saying, you know, this is what we kind of know about network television, that they get really competitive and they get really nasty with each other. And then, of course, they'll go to something like the Emmys and they'll all smile, you know, fake smiles with each other. Like, so there's this story, the one that really sticks out is Diane Sawyer over at ABC, when Katie was at NBC, wasn't it, or CBS? I forget.
NBC.
Okay. Diane Sawyer scored a big interview, not with a politician, not with a movie star, but with some woman who'd given birth to twins at the age of 57. And when Diane Sawyer gets the big get, Couric admits, she says, I said, I wonder who she had to blow.
Right. Well, first off, thanks for having me on, Tim.
Sure.
But yeah, with Couric, I think this really just shows the whole sort of America's sweetheart. She's just the nice girl next door. No, not really. She is nasty. And I think this book is really going to show that. And I guess maybe that might be what she's going for. But yeah, she really does not like Diane Sawyer. She attacks her for getting that interview, which, come on, let's face it. If she had the opportunity to do that interview with that woman, of course she would.
She wanted it. That's why she's mad.
Right. It's just jealousy. But she trashes Sawyer in really kind of the most vulgar terms. She trashes CBS. Apparently, she is now banned from promoting her book.
Yeah.
On CBS, because she recounts in the book that they wanted her to come back to the CBS morning show, which I guess was probably the early show at the time.
Who knows? They keep changing it. I think we would all universally vote that the title CBS Mornings is terrible. It's This Morning was fine. The early show was fine. Breakfast for Your Head was kind of funny, but CBS Mornings? I mean, what do they think that is? I mean, she basically was like, I'm not doing that again.
Yeah. She basically said, I didn't leave the number one rated show to go on the third rated cheap imitation. It was very harsh. And again, she put all of this stuff in the book. So, but yeah, between that, between Sawyer, the interesting thing is that she doesn't, from what the New York Post is writing, she doesn't seem to be that harsh on Matt Lauer, which really just kind of shows that you were saying she is not some sort of a feminist icon, because it seems like she kind of more or less says she had an inkling of what was going on, but didn't really want to get into it.
Yeah, apparently, in quotes, he was a decent man that she felt it was heartless to abandon, you wrote. And this is one of those things where I think that the standard Lauer excuser sort of said, well, we knew he was a ladies man. This is sort of the same thing we used to hear about Bill Clinton. He was a Casanova,
right.
It doesn't sound plausible that he dropped his pants and said, kiss it. He's more suave and debonair than that. I mean, look, you're already in a bad neighborhood with that. But yeah, I think that's the rap that the New York Post has been doing. Maureen Callahan had a piece where she just spent the whole piece saying what a terrible ally Katie Couric is for other women in the industry. That she was, you know, there's this whole story about Ashley Banfield. And at the time, she was at MSNBC, but she was getting a lot of buzz. And of course, Katie, being this jealous person we're all seeing now, ripped on Ashley Banfield's dad. And now Ashley Banfield's doing an interview saying, you know, my dad was senile, I don't know if the word, or had Alzheimer's or whatever, and said, I wish my daughter could have a nice job, like desk job like Katie Couric, because she was out covering 9/11 or something. And it's like, talk about a bad moment to rip on somebody and inside your own network. And she's telling these stories herself. And it's like, She can't be doing this for the money. It's not like she doesn't have money.
No, it sounds really bitter. And I think the liberal media point to all of this. You mentioned Bill Clinton, whether it's Katie Couric or the Harvey Weinstein situation is, look, you can say that you're maybe in a situation in a workplace where you don't quite know what's going on, or you think something is bad going on, and maybe you can't speak out. But these same people, these same powerful, rich media liberals, cannot then go turn around and talk about all the horrible things that conservative men are doing or are accused of doing when they have been enabling all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what she was saying in the book was that she did not really get along with Brian Gumbel, but she had a much better relationship with Matt.
Right.
And that's probably because she came in with Gumbel and she was the inferior partner. And when they switched hosts, then suddenly Katie Couric's name came first. This is one of those things where you just say, very egotistical. It is what we expect, I suppose, from our television hosts. But yeah, there. I mean, I remember Katie Couric when she was back on Channel 4 here in D.C. She was, that was always her shtick. She was perky. She had personality. And yeah, I think this whole memoir just undercuts all of that and says this was all an act. Or maybe she was that kind of nice person in, you know, in the 80s or the early 90s. But, you know, power corrupts.
Yeah, no, I really could be. I guess that she doesn't care anymore, because why would you put all this stuff in a book? It's not a good look.
Yeah, I really don't understand it. And it's like, you know, being 63 isn't the end of the line for women in television news these days. I mean, look at the Andrea Mitchell's plugging along, Judy Woodruff's plugging along. And I think it just seems to me like she got to a place where everything was beneath her once she couldn't succeed at the CBS Evening News. And they gave her 5 years at that.
Wow, I forgot it was that long.
And it's so funny, because then she's like, I'm not going to the third place morning show. And I'm guessing, Scott, that the rejoinder would have been, well, presently you're on the number three evening show. So right. How down are you going?
Yeah.
You know, you can understand where it's like, I'm sure what they thought was, or what she was thinking was, oh, you're saying to me that you want the perky cheerleader pom-pom girl on the morning show, because I just could never cut it as sober and serious on the evening show. And maybe her morning show personality was a negative, but let's face it, she was never a Rhodes Scholar. She was never there because she was the smartest person in the room. So let's go to another thing that we're working on this week at Newsbusters, the bathroom invasion. What is the bathroom insurrection? Kyrsten Sinema, senator of Arizona, being followed into the bathroom by angry left-wing activists who are basically berating her for not being, you know, not taking the correct political stance. I guess these were people who had campaigned for Sinema to be elected in Arizona. But I think the thing that sort of surprised us is not really much of a story.
No. And I think that I think we all kind of understand that if this were Nancy Pelosi or Ocasio-Cortez being harassed in a bathroom, because that's what it is, not just going into a bathroom, but going to the stall and kind of haranguing someone, that it would get a lot of attention. But it's because Sinema and Manchin, these people are not, you know, if you want to call them moderates or even just center-left Democrats, they are not, the important thing is they are not towing the line when it comes to everything that Joe Biden wants to do. And that's really when a Democratic president is in office, that's where the media really sees themselves as getting the agenda across. And they are obstructing the agenda. So whether you have kayakers at Manchin's houseboat or harassing people in a bathroom, yeah, they don't really care.
Yeah, so you said ABC, up to date, I'm guessing, has totally ignored all this harassing of Sinema and Joe Manchin. CBS had 54 seconds, and NBC was the leader with 134 seconds.
One of those moderate senators still not on board, Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema, who was followed this weekend by progressive activists from a classroom where she teaches into a restroom where they continued to confront her and record her even as she went into a bathroom stall. Sinema responded that those protesters violated school security and students' privacy, writing, "This is wholly inappropriate." Asked about protesters' conduct, the president said,
"I don't think they're appropriate tactics, but it happens to everybody."
Obviously, they have a lot of people on the left, and especially on left-wing Twitter, who think this is the way you're supposed to treat what they call the ruling class. But I think it should be seen as absolutely right that if the roles were reversed and Susan Collins, for example, was obstructing a Trump agenda, we all know that this senator obstructing the Trump agenda would be seen as, you know, the most courageous Joan of Arc or whatever. You know, they would try to pull out all of the superlatives for how wonderful they are. And that's obviously what you're not getting here with Kyrsten Sinema. You're getting These weird, have you seen this? These weird things where they say, well, she and Manchin only represent 2% of America.
Right.
Well, they're two senators. It's like they don't understand. Yeah, there are still 50 Republicans in the Senate. I think this is the problem with media bias in general, is that they just don't get this idea that the Democrats have 50 seats. That's what they have. And they're trying to cram in this enormous multi-trillion dollar spending bill. These are the same people who, when Bush won narrowly, said, well, he better not try to pass anything.
Right. Yeah, no, I don't think these seem to realize 50 is not a majority. It's half. And there really is no kind of discussion about, like you said, should you moderate? Should you try and do the limited things that you can do in a very divided Senate? Because yes, it technically with a vice president, 51 to 50 is more votes, but it's really hard to get there. And they don't seem to want to accept that. And with Sinema in general, we saw this from the very beginning, you know, of this term, because look, just contrast it to John McCain. Do you Yep. ever hear anyone kind of in a positive way talking about maverick Senator Kyrsten Sinema? No, you don't. And we saw that all the time with John McCain. The media loved John McCain when he would kind of stand up to his Republican caucus.
Well, especially the vote under Trump when he refused to repeal Obamacare. And then it was Brian Williams was like, oh, he's a profiling courage. You know, I mean, that is the double standard. I mean, I think that obviously Biden was allowed by the liberal media to run as both a centrist and a leftist,
right?
Because it was like, oh, I'll be in there and I'll make the deals and we'll get things passed. But he also signed a thing of like a Bernie Sanders agenda. So he was, you know, like a lot of politicians, he was campaigning to two sides at once. Now it's sort of coming back to get him. But the news media are, I think it's fair to say, are downplaying the divisiveness among the Democrats. I mean, they're trying not to be too critical. It almost feels like they're being more critical of McConnell and the Republicans for somehow not taking the obvious position, which is, you want it, you pass it.
Right.
Oh, that's a terrible thing now. How dare the Republicans object to the Democrats or, you know, let the Democrats stew in their own juices. This is unfair. The other thing that's that we are watching, one of the other things that we're watching is the Kyle Drennan had this story about how somehow the National School Boards Association, which is a lobbying group of Democrats supporting hacks, was basically saying that protesters, parents protesting at school districts could be somehow comparable to domestic terrorists. You know, and we've obviously seen some of these videos of very angry, screaming parents, mostly about mask mandates in schools, but also on subjects like teaching critical race theory, mm-hmm. teaching gender theory. You know, you better use the 37 pronouns or else. It all has this the sort of, if you don't live in Virginia, the big hot commercial is all this Terry McAuliffe saying in the last debate, you know, that parents shouldn't be allowed to object to what's taught in the classroom.
Right.
And of course, here in Loudoun County nearby, this has been a big story about how the parents in Loudoun County have been advocating against critical race theory. Well, so now it's developed that the Attorney General of the United States is going to throw in with this school board association group and try to get involved with the idea that somehow parents need to be monitored as some sort of dangerous and potentially violent threat.
Yeah, and so what's interesting about that is that, so Merrick Garland, like what he's doing, what he's suggesting, and kind of going along with this idea that these parents can be basically the equivalent of violent terrorists, that's not getting any coverage, that's not being considered extreme, and it kind of goes along with a lot of this coverage in general of critical race theory, where they don't really see it as extreme. Or if there's anything that's extreme, it's the parents' reaction, anyone who would object to it. But I think it also gets to the larger issue of Merrick Garland, who we all remember was a Supreme Court nominee nominated by Barack Obama when Antonin Scalia died. And we were all told at the time by the media that he's Obama's not nominating a moderate. He's a centrist. I think some of them even tried to call him a conservative or a moderate conservative to sort of soothe everyone over and say, it's okay to replace Scalia with Garland. And we see, of course, now that's really absurd. He is not a moderate.
No, and I think that the other fiction here and that we're always fed is the notion of, well, when the Democrats nominated Attorney General, they're going to be really independent of the president. They're going to be really independent of the party in power. I mean, and that wasn't true for Eric Holder. That wasn't true for Loretta Lynch. It wasn't true for Janet Reno. It's generally not true. But these are the fictions that a Democrat media has. Just like, yeah, you can say, well, they suggested Merrick Garland was a moderate to conservative. Well, we can go back and look at Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a moderate. No, she wasn't. She was a radical, and that's who she became. That's why she's the big heroine of the left, but she was sold to people as a moderate. They do this every time. They sold Sonia Sotomayor as moderate. They sold Kagan as more moderate. They sold David Souter, who became a liberal on the court, as a dangerously pro-life whatever, you know, Dan Rather, he's anti-women's rights. I mean, so I just think that, yes, this is the kind of story that they should be doing. Obviously, this is the kind of story that conservatives want them to be doing, which is maybe why they're not doing it. But it's that whole idea of, why are you afraid of people coming to the school board meeting and having a complaint? That is kind of mind-boggling. And yeah, I think if we turn this around and, you know, the parents were going to the school board meeting and saying we need a, gun control inside the schools, if it was somebody in there promoting that we need to be more sensitive to transgenders and you went to the school board and said that, they'd think that was fantastic. So it's just that they have this idea, their reaction to critical race theory is either it's a fiction, nobody's teaching that, or how dare you object to it, and right. You get these Nicole Hannah-Jones lines that, oh, what really means here is they don't want to teach people who Martin Luther King was or this kind of stuff, which is obviously not true. So, I mean, can we say that we'll expect them to get around to this sometime?
I think this is the kind of thing that they'll get to it if and when they're forced to get to it. If I were to guess as to why specifically, you know, they're really trying to bury all this stuff and when it comes to critical race theory, you mentioned the Virginia election that we have here. I think it's because the liberal media and the left in general knows that this issue is not a winner for them. I think they realize that sort of implicitly, even if they won't admit it. And I think that you look at some of these counties in Northern Virginia, look at Loudoun County, I think it's quite possible that some of the things that's happening with the school boards could have a real impact in our state's election. I think some of the things that McAuliffe said, that ad that's being repeated where he says, you know, parents shouldn't have a right to be involved, I think this is all going to potentially have a negative impact on the left and on Democrats. So I think the liberal media, I think they sense that and they're trying to cover it up. They don't want to talk about it because they realize it's not a winner for them.
And they're not really covering the Virginia governor's race. I mean, maybe they don't always do that. I think in a year like this, they're not covering the New Jersey governor's race, but that's not perceived to be close. This race now is like within a point. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this would be an interesting measure of how Biden's doing. And that's the way it's going to be evaluated, no matter which way the race goes. Terry McAuliffe was just caught saying to Democrats on a call, on a Zoom call, that, well, we all know Biden's unpopular. So another clip they probably won't be showing on the news media. But we are trying to follow this. So I should wrap with this. We're in October, and I'm going to guess, Scott, that your son Grant is just too young to trick or treat. You can't put a beard on him as Ulysses Grant. Maybe next year. By about next year, he'll probably be able to at least make a few houses.
Maybe next year. But we might try and put some fun costume on if we can think of one.
Well, if you don't want to go for the full beard, I did notice the other day they just marked Chester Arthur's 192nd birthday.
Oh.
I don't know if you guys had a party for that.
I had not seen that.
But Scott is known inside the building as the specialist on the 19th century presidents, especially the post-Civil War ones. But we did discuss, Brett Baer has a book coming out on Ulysses Grant.
He does,
so
I'm
sure you're looking forward to that.
I am. I'm going to read it. But yeah, no, I've always just had a fondness for some of the more obscure post-Civil War presidents. I just think they're fun. They all had an impact.
Scott is on Twitter at ScottJW. And Scott wrote a piece for the Washington Times on Grant a couple of years back. If you Googled Scott Whitlock and Ulysses Grant, you could probably find it. So look it up and come to Newsbusters. This is where you get all the good stuff. Come to us once, twice, 24 times a day. Thanks for listening.